Computer, initialize holosuite.
Good evening and welcome to another broadcast of The Fire Caves, a Star Trek Deep Space Nine podcast. I'm your host, Perry.
And I'm your host, David. And this is Season 1, Episode 3, Past Prologue. Before we continue, you can find us on Twitter and Facebook as The Fire Caves, a Star Trek Deep Space Nine podcast.
Absolutely. So tonight, as we dive in, again, the episode we're talking about is Past Prologue. Past Prologue is an episode that is about the Bajoran resistance fighters known as the Khon Ma. The Khon Ma are kind of an extremist group that, as extremist groups do, take certain measures that other Bajorans, while fighting the Cardassians, wouldn't necessarily have taken. They were very much a winner-take-all, everything. The ends justified the means. They did not matter if they were murdering children, as long as they achieved whatever their objective was. This is something that apparently is found particularly distasteful, not just by the Cardassians, but also the Bajorans, and it has set up kind of a rift there in the society. When we first start the episode, we see that a Cardassian ship is pursuing a Bajoran ship, and happens to be that there is a Khon Ma resistance fighter on this ship, and the Cardassians want him badly. He clearly has some connection to Kira and her past. When he comes aboard the station, she recognizes him. And the episode basically evolves to where Kira is trying her best to find a way to make it possible for the Khon Ma operative, whose name is
Tana Los.
Yes, Tana Los, giving him the opportunity to basically come back home, be repatriated to Bajoran society, and to stop the fighting. And also make it possible for other Khon Ma operatives to come home as well. She meets some initial resistance from Sisko, who's trying to kind of feel out the situation. And then we later see that Tana really had no intention of just coming home and laying down arms. He just can't seem to put the past aggression behind him. He can't seem to move on. He even states that, you know, he wants Bajor for Bajorans. He doesn't want any aliens or outsiders there. And he's come up with this plan to basically destroy the wormhole, or destroy the access to the wormhole, so that everyone loses interest in the Bajoran system and they can leave Bajor alone. He makes contact with some oldie but goodie fan favorite villains, the Duras sisters, Lursa and Bator, and he is attempting to get some materials from them in order to make a bomb that he's going to use to destroy the wormhole. Also during this episode, we meet the character Garrick, the Clothier, the Cardassian, the only Cardassian still living on Deep Space Nine. He makes contact with our very young, naive doctor, Dr. Julian Bashir. And Julian is completely intrigued by the fact that Garrick has made contact with him. And he's very excited and also kind of scared. And it's kind of funny to watch him kind of run around and get some kind of reaction from the senior staff, who seem like they could care less that Garrick has made contact with our doctor. That's kind of like the B side of our main story here with Tana. We also find that Lursa and Bator have made a side deal with Garrick to basically turn Tana Los over to the Cardassians after they have made their deal, their transaction with Tana. Okay, so of course, Sisko and crew discover what it is that Tana's really up to. And this leads to kind of a cat and mouse fight on the runabouts that we see, the extensive use of the runabouts for the first time. And of course, Tana is ultimately thwarted in his plan by Kira, whom he had taken hostage. So that's kind of the episode in a nutshell. Again, there's obviously much more to it. But if you haven't seen it by now, again, the show is like 25 years old. So what are you doing? Get out there and watch it. And watch the next episodes so that you're ready for our show when we come back next week. And you can, of course, follow along and join in and know what we're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah, it was an interesting episode. It was a good one. You know, you get to introduced to a number of new characters. I have not yet met the Duras sisters in my current watching through of The Next Generation. So I'm look forward to finding out more about them. Seems like they have more of a history than is revealed in this particular episode.
Oh, but yeah.
But yeah, you got I realized that in the middle of the episode. I was like, oh, there's something about a civil war that happens. I mean, there was I haven't yet. I'm only in season four of The Next Generation, but I understand that something's going to happen in the future.
So you're right up on it. You're right up on it. It's coming up real soon in next gen.
That's my understanding. I look forward to hearing more about them. And I don't know. Maybe we'll see more of these sisters. Perry, you can confirm or deny that.
Well, we do.
Yeah. Of course, the most interesting new character is Tana Loos, which, I mean, this is early enough in the show. We have plenty of opportunity to see more of him, I'm sure, especially because he directly has something to say to Kira, Major Kira. You know, she is supposed to be on his side. He pressures her throughout the episode to prove her loyalty to the Bajorans. And she says, my loyalty is to the Bajorans, but we are in a new situation. We are trusting the Federation to help us reorganize our government and to gain independence for ourselves, and to continue to fight and kill and terrorize is going to be a mistaken approach. She says she regrets some of the things she's done with Tana Loos before. We haven't heard much about what that is. I look forward to finding out more. But at this time, she is having to take a clear stand about where she belongs. Is she going to stand with the new Bajoran temporary government as they look forward to reorganizing themselves and being independent? Or is she going to fight against the Federation and Sisko and the others in order to make clear that only the Bajorans should have any influence over their history?
Absolutely. Even at the end of the episode, we see where Tana, now apprehended, looks at Kira in disgust and calls her a traitor.
Yep.
You know, and you see how deeply that did affect her, because, you know, throughout the whole episode, that's what this episode is definitely about. It's Kira's loyalties. She, as much as she used to be a resistance fighter, she is now leading the charge in a new framework of Bajoran society.
Yeah,
and she has to reconcile that old fighter nature in herself with this new kind of bureaucratic side.
Yeah,
that is what Bajor needs right now. They need someone who's helping to rebuild the infrastructure, getting the people back on their feet. And as she points out to Tana, you know, like the wormhole is important. It's going to make Bajor, you know, a power in the quadrant. He's like, I don't want Bajor to be a power in the quadrant. I want Bajor for Bajorans, which, you know, not that I've ever been in that kind of situation, but it just seems so narrow-minded to think that you just, you know, want to close yourself off to just this very xenophobic isolationist viewpoint. And I think that was kind of the greater implication of the episode, too, is like, where do you go when you come from this very, you know, savage, war-torn background? How do you move forward into the future? What does it take?
Right.
And this is the commentary that they're giving here in the episode. What is it? Which way do you go? Do you kind of, you know, go that route of still maintaining this very hostile, militaristic mindset? Or do you turn the corner and start to rebuild, repair, and branch out and establish a new kind of working relationship with the people around you?
Yeah. So, Perry, how long has it been since you've last seen this episode?
So, as we talked before, you know, my memory is pretty extensive. So, I believe that it's been about 2 years since the last time I watched this episode. When I watch Trek, like, I watch Star Trek all the time. And, obviously, Deep Space Nine is one of my favorites. But I don't I certainly don't follow the path. Like, I don't always start at the pilot and then work my way through every episode. I pick and choose now. Like, and so there will be some days where I want to watch an episode from maybe season 5, but it, you know, or season 7. I've noticed that lately with Deep Space Nine in particular, I have focused more on season 7 than any others. And I think that's because season 7 is the one that I watched the least, because I knew that it was ending, and it's like I don't want to watch the end. So now I'm like, I tend to go there more, but as for everything else, like, it's been a long time since I've watched them. And then, of course, there's so many other shows now. You know, I also, when I'm feeling that urge to watch Star Trek, I'll watch an episode of Next Generation or Voyager or Lower Decks or Discovery, or even, you know, I just recently went through about 3 episodes of Picard, you know. So I just kind of just jump around these days to get my Trek fix. But yeah, this episode is just one of those early ones that, while good, it just was never one that I wanted to come back to a whole lot. So yeah,
sure.
It's been about 2 years, and I think I got it mostly right. I might have got a couple of things out of order here and there, but I think I got it mostly right.
Oh, no, you did. It's, again, to our audience, Perry's memory has always been just amazing. He and I will talk about anecdotes from years past, and he'll be talking about something, and I'll be like, I don't remember that at all. But he knows every detail, the person we were talking to. It's one thing that's great about Perry. He knows, remembers things very well. And makes him a great host of this podcast.
Memory is great now. Don't tell my daughter that. Wait till she, you know, gets older and discovers that I still remember when she did whatever. We'll see if it's still a great thing.
You'll have some great stories to embarrass her with.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. So, let's get right to it. David, any standout performances, any breakouts that just really took you away when you were watching this episode?
Well, this is definitely a Kira-centric episode in a certain sense. Every episode from The Next Generation to Deep Space Nine, I think you can usually tell if there's one character who gets a little more focused than others. And so Kira, is the major character. Major Kira is the major character. Haha, I made a joke. Of the episode, in the sense that she has to make the biggest decisions for the episode. And I'm really enjoying Nana Visitor. Is it Visitor? Nana? Yeah, I'm enjoying her performance. She does play this character well. She plays with this. Major Kira is convict. It always has conviction. And this is an episode where she has to figure out, what does her conviction really mean? What is it leading her toward? And so, yeah, that moment where she goes into Odo's office and pretends to ask a question about, oh, are things going to go according to what we talked about? And Odo catches on that, you know, she's not asking that question. She has something else on her mind. And he pressures her. Not pressures her. He points to her and says, okay, I can tell. You know, I can't always reproduce human behavior or humanoid beings' behavior as well as other things. You know, like, I have a hard time creating a nose, is what he says, but I can tell that there's something bothering you. And she lays it out for him. She says, whatever decision I make, I'm betraying someone. And you get that. Yeah, this is a moment for Kira. This is gonna set her up. Whatever happens after this sets her up for the future. And you know, there's something about her relationship with Odo. I mean, I haven't seen a lot of it yet, but from last episode, we saw how she was loyal to Odo. And this episode, he's loyal to her in the sense that he can tell he's a friend to her. He can tell that there's something going on. He pressures her to work it out and then calls Sisko. He calls up Sisko and says, hey, Kira has something that she needs to tell you. And he just turns his chair around and turns his back on her in a sense in that moment. But it's not a turn his back on her in the sense that he's you know, rejecting her. It's he's turning his back on her in the sense of, like, I can't help you make this decision, so I'm not going to pretend to talk you through it and make you feel better. You have to sit here with the consequences of the choice you're about to make, which he's, you know, forcing her to make again because he called Sisko. But yeah, he's a tough friend in that moment to her, and she follows through. So yeah, she's doing a great job. Everyone else is doing a great job. Julian Bashir, he's so excited. Oh, Garrick's come and he wants to be a friend, and oh, it must mean something. And he falls into a plot, not because he intends with it, but Garrick plays an interesting role in this episode. He insinuates that he knows the Cardassian leadership and can turn over Tana to the Cardassian warship. But at no point do we ever see him actually communicate with any Cardassian. He could have been BSing the whole time, and he actually is this neutral figure that he claims he is. So I look forward to finding out, is he more of an insidious character, which he comes off as? You know, he seems to, he's always smiling, and, you know.
Insidious is a great word for him, especially in this episode. He's very, he kind of creepy in a way. Like,
right.
I remember when I watched it the first time, and, you know, when we meet them, he and Bashir are, well, I think Bashir is having lunch or something by himself.
Yes.
And Garrick walks up to him. And I remember when I watched that and saw Garrick walking up to him, I thought that there was something wrong with him. Like, the way he was walking and coming up, I was like, he's stalking him. That's my first thought was, he's clearly stalking this man.
Yeah.
You know, but, he comes off as very, very creepy. He's always, like, kind of looking around, like, wondering if anybody's watching him.
You know? The Cardassian makeup with the pale coloration and almost the ribbed, you know, almost reptilian.
The corrugated ridges.
Yeah, he looked all the Cardassians have a kind of vampiric look. And in that moment, he could have definitely just gone straight for Bashir's neck. He would have been like, yep, he's a living alien vampire in this universe.
And, you know, and you're right. You made a point, and I don't know why I never thought about that until now. But, like, when the Klingon sisters, Lursa and Bator, make contact with Garrick, you know, we never in this episode see Garrick actually talk to other Cardassians.
Right.
So when Garrick is acting like he's this intermediary, we have no way of knowing whatsoever if that's like a legitimate position for him or not. Now, again, it's early on in the show, so I guess we kind of, it's easy to believe that about him because it's early on in the show's run. It's the third episode.
Right.
We have no, and we've never seen this character before.
Right.
So we don't know. But now, thinking about it and looking back, I feel like this might have been more of a Garrick scheming as a way to ingratiate himself to the Federation and to Bajor.
Right. Yeah.
Because, you know, he's got no other reason for it. And, of course, he uses the doctor to get the information out. So it's just like, you know, even Sisko says, it sounds like he's trying to, you know, make contact, get this information. You know,
right.
He's using you, doctor, so go. Do as he asks.
Right.
But, yeah, so I don't think that he ever really had any intention of ever turning Tana over to the Cardassians. I think that his goal from the beginning was to show the Federation and to show Bajor that, you know, he could play ball, basically. And he was gonna help them out.
Whatever. Well, don't insinuate too much for me now. I haven't seen enough.
I certainly haven't. Trust me. I was thinking about it as I was saying it. I was like, I'm not telling him anything. That, you know, it's very episode specific. So that's that. Yeah.
Well, the reason I found that interesting that Garrick was coming off as playing both sides, but we never get confirmation that he really is because this episode is full of playing both sides. Tana is pretending to be a reformed Khan Ma. Kira is trying to figure out whether or not she wants to still be allied with the Khan Ma. The Duras sisters, as soon as they get what they want, they're going to betray Tana faster than they can flip him out of, you know, an airlock. And so here's Garrick as the only character of amongst all these other characters who you as an audience member are like, oh yeah, this dude, he's a Cardassian. We hate the Cardassians. Of course he's a spy. But he does try to work with the Federation here, and he doesn't. Mm-hmm. There's no active, clear indication of who he is truly allied with in terms of he doesn't talk with the Cardassians in a way we see him. So I found this episode, as I was watching it, I was kind of reeling. I was like, oh, man, all these characters, I got to keep track of who's betraying who.
Yeah, you know, that's one thing about Deep Space Nine that I always loved was that, you know, I think from beginning to end of the series, they do a great job of giving us complexity and building on things, you know. And considering that in the history of Trek, it's always been a very episodic show. And beyond the occasional two-parter episode, the episode that preceded the one that you're watching didn't necessarily have a tie-in.
Right.
You know, whereas with Deep Space Nine, you could almost watch it and feel like each episode is a progression of their day. Like, this was day one, day two, day three, you know, and because they make general hints to things that happened in the last episode.
Yes. You know? Yeah. This one definitely ties more into the pilot than the last episode did. Yeah.
Exactly. You know, so there's these constant little bits of callbacks that they do to keep the entire story relevant. And that is something that does not go away in the DS9 run. Even when you're in season 7, you will find things they talk about that relate all the way back to season 1. So that's the only spoiler I'm going to give you on that. And you'll probably forget it by the time you get to season 7 anyway. But
Garrick, main character, season 7. Got it.
There you go. Yes. Garrick is the captain by season 7, just so you know. He's the captain. But yeah, so then we talk your standouts. What is something about the episode that you hated? Like, you wish that it wasn't even in there, but it just kind of, it sticks out.
The image of alien beings wearing lingerie is the absolutely most terrifying thing I can think of. When the Duras sisters go in to meet Garrick, his first response is, "Would you like to buy some lingerie?" And he holds up something, which, I mean, please, dear God, don't ever have me think through what that might look like.
So that's also kind of a little bit of a joke thrown at the Dura sisters, in particular Beator. She's more the lustful one, you know, and this is something that is played out with her character multiple times when you see her through Next Generation and some other things, and then of course Deep Space Nine. So, you know, it's just like they're just kind of hinting at the fact that she is definitely a bit more promiscuous than her no-nonsense sister.
Gotcha. Person. I look forward to, again, seeing these characters as they originally appeared on Next Generation and laughing at this moment.
Yeah. Lursa and Beator, they are some definitely the most famous Klingon women that we ever encounter.
Right.
But, I can remember watching them when I was little, obviously, and watching Next Generation. And I don't know, there was something about them that, like, I both loved and hated them. I don't know, I can't explain it any better than that. Like, there was just something about them. Like, I obviously hated them because they were set up to be the villain, you know, in the story. But something else about their overall interactions that I found very enjoyable. And, there's a particular scene with Picard where he kind of puts him down a little bit, and you watch their face fall. And I think I've watched that particular episode like a bajillion times because I just love seeing that interplay between the two of them. Picard so, you know, proper and regal and everything, and then you have these two being ridiculous, and he's just like, and I was like, oh man, yeah, let's do that again. Do that again.
You might say that you love to hate them and you hate that you love them.
Yes. I guess I could say that. I mean, I may talk bad about them, but if somebody else who's like outside the fandom ever was like, oh yeah, I watched one episode and those two Klingon chicks were terrible, I'd be like at their throat. Like, how dare you? You do not talk about them that way. I can say that. Only I can say that.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
So Klingons in lingerie is not your favorite.
Well, I mean, Cardassians in lingerie as well, for the record. Actually, hey, on this point, you know, I've always wondered what it would take to, I mean, put on all that makeup as a Cardassian or a Klingon, or even Odo or Data, you know, the makeup they went through. You mind telling me a little bit about kind of what their experience was as actors, putting on some pretty elaborate makeup every episode?
Well, so there's a famous story about Rene and his Odo mask, that he, as much as he loved the mask, you know, these actors are doing these shows and it's, you know, 18-hour days of filming, and they get there at like, you know, 3-4 in the morning and have to put this on, and then they got to wear it all day,
right?
You know, and so Ronald Moore, who is a who was a writer and director for a couple of episodes on the show and everything like that, you know, he tells the story of how after like the last bit of filming, Renee pulled his Odo mask off, and it was just this nasty ball of sweat, and it was just gross. And
right.
He says that Renee took it off and flung it at him, and it just hits with this like wet smack, you know, from being just sweaty and everything else. And he threw it at him, and he's kept it ever since, and he's had right. it ever since.
That's
wait a second,
what you should
was that,
do. Yeah.
Was that Ronald Moore or was that Ira Bear? So I guess my memory failed on this one. I think that was actually Ira Stephen Bear, who's like the showrunner producer for Deep Space Nine.
You betrayed me, Terry. I talked up your memory.
Talked about it, and then I just totally botched on. Anyway, it happened. One of those two guys did it, okay? So, and they've kept it. Worf has talked extensively about how the makeup was, you know, a very grueling thing for him at first, you know, because they got to get everything just right, and the color and everything else. And of course, you know, as the show goes on, they get better
right.
at it. You know?
Oh, I'm sure, yeah.
The guy who plays Quark, Armin Shimerman, he was actually on the Regis and Kathy Lee show way back in the day, and he comes on the show as himself, but then he steps off and comes back on dressed in full Quark makeup and gear and everything else. And so he was able to do that change relatively quickly for the sake of being on their morning show. But he talked, I think he said it took them something like, you know, 3 to 4 hours normally to get him fully into it, and did the teeth and the fingernails and get the head just right and all that kind of stuff. So, and even, you know, Terry Farrell, who plays Dax, you know, her getting her spots and stuff right on the side of her head and down her neck and everything else, you know, she said that, you know, sometimes that would take a lot of time because it wasn't, they didn't just like use like a roll of stickers or something and just put it on. They're actually hand painted on her
right.
each time.
Right.
You know, so, you know, a lot of attention to detail goes into that, and it pays off because it looks great on screen. They look absolutely fantastic. And it's one of those things that as a fan and someone who's thought of dabbling in cosplay, you know, that's the thing that's really kept me from going full Klingon and getting the hair and the thing. Because I don't want it to look crappy. So it's like if I'm gonna do it, I wanna look really good when I do it. But it's gonna take a while and it's gonna be hot, and I just don't know if I have both the money and the patience to sit there for 4 hours while someone makes me into a Klingon. But
oh, Perry, you know that as soon as you saw the final result, you would have been very happy to have sat there for 4 hours.
I was gonna say, you know, but yeah, I think that I'd make a terrific Klingon.
I think
if it would ever happen, I'd be fantastic.
Yeah.
It'd be like, I just discovered the real me.
You have the physique for it. For the record, everyone, Perry, you played some football in college, and you can imagine, Perry, you're what, 6'4"?
How dare you? I am 6'8".
6'8", nah.
Don't you deny
again,
me my last four inches.
Well, as you can imagine, Perry could play a very intimidating Klingon, or intimidating, well, I don't know what, whatever alien race you want to give him.
But I think, though, that the people who had the most extensive makeup, back to that subject, and not me being an impressive Klingon, I think the Cardassians are the ones who had the most extensive makeup, because it's not just changing their skin tone, but, you know, they also had to get those ridges and the depression in the forehead, the spoon head look, as it had been termed a couple of different times, getting that just right. And then, of course, making it actually look like, you know, skin, and it's, you know, it got a little bit of a shine to it because they're sweating, and it's got to work with the different skin tones and everything else. So I think that the Cardassians were running, you know, pardon the expression, neck and neck with Klingons when it came to who had the most extensive makeup and costume.
Yeah.
So
you can definitely tell that. Yeah, you can definitely tell that they took what they learned with the Klingons and and made it more extensive with the Cardassians.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So, a little side note, real quick. Early on in the episode, Kira, when she's trying to secure the Cone Maw on the station, she makes a call to an Admiral Roman.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And this is a fact that I found out just a little bit ago. I'm going to say probably about a month ago, because I was thinking about this episode. And that Admiral Roman is actually none other than Susan Bay Nimoy. She's Adam Nimoy's, Leonard Nimoy's wife.
Is that right?
So, yeah. So, a little bit of Star Trek royalty inserted there into Deep Space Nine. Just a little tidbit Easter egg there.
Yeah.
So, whenever you're watching that episode and you see that rather stern-faced woman that comes on and kind of, you know, listens to Kira but then gives Sisko the business, you know, and Sisko's like, you ever go above my head again? You know, that admiral that they're talking to right there, that's actually Leonard Nimoy's wife. And, don't know why I never knew that until fairly recently, but it, like, I don't know, for some reason it just enhanced the episode a little bit for me. So I like to bring that up for people.
That's great.
When I see that, yeah.
Yeah, that was a fun scene where he never brings up to, Sisko never brings up to Kira that he knew the Admiral had spoken to, or that Kira had spoken to the Admiral until they were talking, you know, about what they were going to do. And he says, you know, if you ever go over my head again, I'll have your head on a platter. And he, you know, Sisko, Avery Brooks, Avery Brooks plays that. He plays a soft-spoken character very well. He plays this, he looks at you, and he doesn't yell, he doesn't scream, but he very quietly tells you, you cross him again, you ain't going to live to regret it.
Right. He'll murder you in your sleep.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I have to say, by the way, Perry, you know, tell me if I'm wrong here, but Avery Brooks as Sisko, maybe it's just the camera angles, they got to get them, but he always does this thing I've noticed, you know, he gets up real close to characters and like talks with them, and I'm always imagining that he's about to give them a quick peck on the lips and startle the character, the actor, just to get some sort of reaction. I was like, back up, bro, give him like 6 inches.
You know, I think that that's just something that they do in Star Trek, because, you know, a lot of the actors do, and in particular, it's a thing they like to do with the captains, putting them face-to-face, and not just, like, face-to-face, but, like, their noses are almost touching.
Right.
You know? I can think of, there's a scene in particular with Captain Janeway on Voyager with her and her chief engineer, B'Elanna Torres, and they're, like, musing on how to solve whatever the issue is, and at one point, they both come up with the idea at virtually the same time, and they're so excited, and they run together to talk, and seriously, they're like, they're sharing each other's air. They're so close. And right. And every time I watch that scene, I always say the same thing. I'm like, why are you guys so close?
Right.
Like, why, who decided that we needed to get your faces that close together? And and they do it a lot, now that I think about it. They do it a lot on Voyager. There's another episode where they're like, where there's three people in the scene. There's the captain on one side, this other character, Neelix, in the middle, and then, you know, his love interest girlfriend, Kes, on the other side. And they are, like, literally pressing him to make a decision, and their faces are, like, just, like, right there. I'm like, why are you guys standing so close to this man? Like, back up.
Yeah.
It's like, and it's now that you pointed out, I'm like, I can't wait to see Star Trek, like, filmed in post-COVID scenarios, and how now everybody is across the room, and we're just supposed to take that as, okay, now that's normal.
Yeah.
Okay, like, we can fit a whole football field between the two of you. Like, why are you so far away?
Every camera angle is just a single shot of a single character. There's no two characters in the same shot. Yeah, as you were talking, I was thinking, you know, actually, Jonathan Frakes as Riker on The Next Generation sometimes. I mean, he usually seems to do it more with, you know, when he's trying to woo a female character on some level. But he's the one who seems to sometimes be a little in the personal space of
They're just always up on each other, which, you know, when you hear their stories, from, you know, back then, and they're working in the uniforms and it's spandex and it's hot and it's smelly and all this stuff. Right. And I'm like, and yet you guys were like right up on each other, smelling each other and everything else all the time. Did none of you think to maybe back up a little bit, like, yeah. or tell the guys, hey, stop putting my marker on the floor 2 inches from their marker. Like, I'm going to need you to maintain some kind of distance, bro. Like, it's very interesting how they film that. And again, there's no real explanation why, because I don't know of a time in my life where I've ever been so excited to talk to a person that I literally want to share their air.
Right.
Right. That I want to, when they exhale, I'm inhaling. Because that's basically how close these guys are.
Yeah.
When they're doing these scenes. But yeah. But I think that they do a better job of it a little bit in Deep Space Nine, in the sense that in most cases when it's happening, someone is delivering information at least at a hushed tone. So it almost is intimating that they're close because they're speaking softly. Like even when Sisko is delivering that threat, you know, it's almost like he's doing it to where only she can hear.
Right. Well, that scene is actually great because in that moment, that scene where he says, I'll have your head on a platter, he's standing above her, but he's like almost, it looks like at least a foot, not if not 2 feet above her in that moment. So visually, he's got the height on her in that scene as well. And so when he tells her, I'll have your head on a platter, it looks like he could just reach out his hand and just...
Well, yes, he is on like the steps that lead up to the office, but also Avery Brooks is quite tall himself. So from my understanding, that's always been the thing that kind of threw them on some stuff too. So, yeah. Okay. So is there anything about this episode that you feel like you would... besides people, that you would like to see again?
Well, I mean, the Kon Ma is an interesting idea. The idea that there are these freedom fighters that haven't given up the fight, even though, you know, the Cardassians are gone. Like, you've been victorious on that level. But as Tana says, we don't want the Federation just, you know, trading in the Federation for the Cardassians. That's not what we want. You know, his decision to destroy the wormhole, which, as we learned in the first episode, not only has commercial trading interests for the Bajorans, but is also a spiritual hub on some level. Mm-hmm. Remind me what the devices
the Celestial Temple, the House of the Prophets.
Yeah, the tears originate from
there. Yes, the orbs. Orbs, the tears of the prophets.
Yeah, so
the orbs come from there.
So we're setting up a overarching storyline for the season and show, assuming that we continue with these plot lines. That we need to keep the wormhole. I mean, the fact that this wormhole is a steady wormhole, as we've seen in both The Next Generation, in several instances. You know, wormholes in the Next Generation shows that I've seen so far are. The important thing is that they're unsteady, or their endpoints are not steady. There's one episode in The Next Generation where there's a planet,
a bidding war,
exactly,
a bidding war for the wormhole that it has a fixed point in the Alpha Quadrant,
right.
But its endpoint is wagging around
exactly
out there somewhere. Yeah,
exactly. So the idea that this wormhole near the Bajorans is steady on both ends, that's really important. And as we talked about in the last episode. You know, Keiko O'Brien is lamenting a little bit the fact that she won't be able to be one of those explorers. The fact that Tana Los would be willing to... their original fear is that he would blow up Deep Space Nine. Which, remind me, so Perry, Deep Space Nine was built by the Cardassians.
Yes. Space Nine, originally called Tarak Nor, is a Cardassian mining station. They used to mine uridium ore from the planet, and it was processed up there. And then once it was taken, it would be taken from the planet, brought to the mining facility where it was processed and refined, and then sent off in various ships to wherever it is the Cardassians needed to send it.
Right. You
know?
So I was going to say that, you know, the idea that he would destroy that, that's a Cardassian symbol. He would destroy a Cardassian symbol. That would make sense, at least in his mind. But the fact that he would destroy the wormhole, which would arguably be explicitly a Bajoran resource on some level, he's willing to do that. It's a more bold but also more self-destructive choice.
Yeah, it's ultimately self-defeating, and I think that that's also one of the other points they were trying to make in this episode with people like Tana, who can't get over their past, who can't put down the war, and who can't find a new purpose for things, you know.
Right.
Tana is very much, you know, he's stuck in the old ways, and he's kind of, it almost seems like he's less angry about the so-called, about the Federation being there than he is about kind of the ending of hostilities between the Cardassians and the Bajorans. You know, he's more than willing to carry on the fight.
Right.
You know, when we first see him, again, he's on a ship and he's fighting with the Cardassians out in space somewhere.
Right.
And you just know it wasn't him just, you know, like, yeah, his ship is badly beaten and it's not really firing back or anything like that. But you just know that it didn't start that way. You know that he was probably attacking someone somewhere else.
Right.
While he was, you know, making that jump to come to Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
So, you know, for those guys who can't really put it down, who can't walk away from it, who can't, you know, figure out what to do with themselves in peacetime, Tana is a perfect example of, you know, kind of the extreme end of that.
Right.
He is still looking to carry on that fight, and he's now gone and made the very people that he was fighting for his enemy, you know, and he is going to do this thing that is ultimately going to hurt all of them. If he is successful in destroying the wormhole and destroying the Celestial Temple, he would be cutting off Bajor from their gods, from the right. people that have been influencing their development, their culture, everything,
right,
for forever, for as long as there's been a Bajor, there has been, you know, the prophets and doing what they're doing. So
right,
yeah, very self-defeating, self-destructive thing that Tana is attempting to do here.
Right.
And yeah, it's interesting that it seems to me anyway, and remember thinking about the episode, that Kira, as torn as she is on trying to whether or not she should help him, I feel like she doesn't really come around until she discovers ultimately that that's what he's trying to do.
Right.
When she recognizes that his plot is going to cut Bajor off from their gods, I think that's when she really was like, okay, you're done. Like, anything up to that point, I think she felt like, while still wrong, she could have talked him out of. Versus now that he's leveled this thing at the gods, she's like, no, we've got to stop you any means necessary. I'm ready to, you know, be a part of the plot to bring you down.
You know? I don't personally remember her reasoning being tied so much to the religious significance. To me, it seemed more it was the political significance of his action that she was objecting to. But yeah, I mean, that's certainly my point, is that the wormhole has multiple functions. This is really yeah. important. And so to just toss that away for some, you know, level of independence, I mean, perfect, unsullied, uninfluenced independence is a mistake. I mean, you got to have relationships with these other cultures. I mean, the Cardassians yeah. aren't just going to go away. They right. were willing to abuse Bajor in the past, and all they have to do is decide that it's worth going back there and reconquering Deep Space Nine and the planet and telling the Federation off, and, you know, be willing to fight off the Federation, and they're right back to where they started. So the Federation is an ally. Don't, you know, antagonize them just because you are a Bajoran and that's who I am. That's yeah. a mistake. We're going to regret your decision. So, yeah, yeah.
So one of the things that I also love about this episode, too, and you touched on it a little bit earlier, is the evolving Sisko-Odo dynamic. You know, Odo discovers that there is something else going on here, you
right.
know. And, you know, he clues Sisko in, and they're talking about it, and it's just like, do we want to say anything to Kira about this? And Sisko's like, no, because, you know, even if she's not necessarily aware of it, her being involved in some way could give them more information. And so I like to see that, especially considering how antagonistic the two of them started out. When Odo right. and Sisko first meet each other, there was a very clear dislike.
Right.
Now, you could argue that that's one-sided because Odo is just antagonistic with everybody. He doesn't really get along with anyone. you know, and Sisko's just kind of, he's very aloof in those first moments, you know, so
yep.
You can almost say that he didn't notice, but to see that there has been a very quick change between them. And this is, and or I wouldn't really say, I guess, a very quick change, but again, in the first episode, we see they're kind of antagonistic. The second episode, we see that Sisko is very supportive, but also within limits. You know, when, as we talked about last time, Odo gives his very impassioned speech about, you know, justice and what justice is, and Sisko immediately counters with, no, you will follow the rules. Like, you're not going to go around here, you know, dishing out your form of justice. We have rules. We have a code of conduct, and you will follow it, right, or I'll find someone else who can. So it's like they've both done a lot to be challengers to each other. And then to see them in this episode where it's like it's clear that there's been enough time for them to develop some kind of understanding of each other, and now they're supporting each other in this moment. Yeah. And it's one of the relationships that I picked up on early in my watching of the show, and I loved to watch its development as the series went on.
Yeah.
I was like, you know what? They could do a whole, like, sub-series where it's just the two of them going around and, like, solving crimes and stuff, and it's like Odo kind of needing Sisko to rein him back in a bit as he's trying to dole out justice, and then Odo is there to kind of tell Sisko that sometimes following the rules is not always the best way. So
they got a good cop, bad cop thing.
Yeah, yes. I would love to see that from the two of them. Like, Sisko's retired, but, you know, still wants to be in action in some way. And Odo is ageless, so they just, you know, pick up and keep going.
Yeah.
So now for our little bit of cultural reference here, our historical reference, like I guess I like to include on every show. This one was a little bit harder to get into and research. But one of the things that we've talked about a lot, obviously, is the Konma and their resistance fighting and their, you know, obviously he's struggling to let go of the war. Right. So this would be something that, to me, was a good tie-in to soldiers affected by PTSD, which in the mid to late 90s, this was an issue that was gaining a lot of traction, right?
Right.
It was kind of looked at as like the, you know, best-kept secret of the military, right? We had these guys who were suffering, and this is actually the first time that we saw that they were going through and reclassifying a lot of cases as PTSD, okay? Right. So now we had a lot of different conflicts that were happening in the 90s. You know, we had, the Gulf War. We had the conflict Desert Storm, which is early on in the 90s as well. And then I always forget this other one. Stupid memory. I wish you hadn't said anything. I think you jinxed me. Like, you talked about it, and now my memory's failing me hardcore. Wow. So,
oh, well.
But, yeah. But anyway. This is the first time in the 90s that we really saw people paying more attention to soldiers who were afflicted by PTSD and them doing more to address it.
Right.
The 90s was definitely the time that we became aware, or started, not necessarily became aware, but I guess started to put a greater emphasis on mental health of our soldiers.
Yeah, before that time, it was known as being shell-shocked. That was just, he's a shell-shocked soldier. He just... you know, explosions or popping noises make him kind of just jittery. And that,
right.
Now they actually like, oh, no, this is a thing.
And it was also looked at as, you know, beyond being shell-shocked, like it was also a very specific set of parameters or, I guess, conditions that the person had to exhibit in order to even be considered shell-shocked.
Right.
And as the science developed and the... and the therapies developed, they realized that there were way more people suffering from this in different forms than they had previously realized or had been treating.
Right.
So we saw a rapid expansion of what was considered PTSD.
Right.
And we saw a expansion of how it was treated as well.
Right.
So when you had a lot of these officers who, again, just, you know, couldn't seem to put the war down, couldn't adjust to home life,
right,
you know, this was one of the avenues that was beginning to be addressed, to help them out with it. What we see in this episode, though, is more along the lines of a person who, just never got over it, never got better, and carried that fight home. And I mean, quite literally, he was coming back to his home, and he was going to do something to incite a whole lot of violence.
Right.
Instead, which we know is never really the answer. Mm-hmm. And again, using a bomb, again, another great tie-in culturally to the 90s. We saw a lot of bombings.
Yeah.
Then some of the more infamous ones being like, the first time that the World Trade Center, they attempted to bomb it.
Right.
And then, of course, the infamous Timothy McVeigh and bombing of the Oklahoma City building.
Yeah.
And all those people that died there. So,
yeah
the very volatile nature of these types of people and their weapons of choice, of course, were just very much on display. So,
right. Yeah, the thing I was thinking about as I watched this episode and we're talking, the point of the episode is, like, we have this provincial government, this temporary government, trying to get things working for Bajor in the absence of the Cardassians. Lately, I've been reading a bunch of biographies about Revolutionary War figures, from George Washington to Alexander Hamilton. But the one I'm on right now is a book by the author Harlow Giles Unger, who's written a number of biographies. And the one I'm reading right now is about the Marquis de Lafayette, who was a young 20-year-old French nobleman who came over and participated in the war along with many other French nobles. And I'm at the point in the book now where he's back in France, and he is a figure in the French Revolution, which turned very bloody and violent. And the juxtaposition of the American Revolution and then the founding of the nation under the Constitution, you know, there was a lot of animosity amongst the Americans about, you know, what is this Constitution? This is going to set up a government. It's going to be autocratic. There's going to be, you know, aristocrats of some kind. They're going to abuse the people. But, you know, they spent a lot of time debating what they were going to do about creating a government. And then over in France, Lafayette is trying to do the same thing. But as people will know with history, you know, France, their revolution was bloody and violent. I haven't yet got to the part in this biography where they're, you know, got the guillotine out and they're just chopping off heads, but like that's the next chapter, I'm sure. And this episode really put that, you know, historical perspective for me in the moment for this episode, because, you know, Tana Los is the one who's willing to use violence to get what he wants. And there have been studies done that show that, for example, the civil rights, you know, Martin Luther King's efforts of peaceful protests to get change made in cultures are more successful than violent attempts to get things done, or at least they're more long-term successful. And you just see Tana Los and you feel for him, you feel for Kira, you feel for the Bajorans, you trust, at least, you know, we haven't seen a whole lot of immediate suffering from the Cardassians necessarily, but we understand the idea that they have been abused and ruled by by people who tortured and killed people, you know, at their whim and stole their natural resources. But you know that Tana Los's choices are just going to backfire. He is doing everything wrong at this point. While you could argue for his choices, you know, maybe 10, 5 years ago in order to get the Cardassians to leave, now we got to move to a new era. We got to form a government, we got to figure out how we're going to create our society and our culture, and we have to move on. And as a character, you know, he, in this episode, he was offered amnesty. That's what Kira was doing for him in this episode. She was working really hard to get amnesty, and he accuses her of being a politician, and she is shocked and offended by that, because she never, of course, considered herself a politician. She's not one of those people who just talks for a living. So she takes action. And this was her taking action in an awkward, uncomfortable, difficult way out of her comfort zone. And he throws it in her face. And reading this biography about Lafayette, who was trying to do the same thing over in France, trying to get cultural change because he knew there were problems in France. As a nobleman, he had immediate understanding of all the issues in the culture and the government, and worked from the inside to make change. And then when all of the people he was trying to help kept refusing his help, whether they be the other noblemen or the king even, or the commoners who were looking to him to lead them, they failed to trust his leadership, and that in the French Revolution that backfired. And I see Tonelos is one of those who is making that same mistake.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I don't know much about the French Revolution beyond what I learned in school, of course. You know,
neither have I. This is my first time really getting into it at all.
But I like to, you know, one, I have to applaud you for, you know, reading those books about revolutionary figures. And I mean, that's not something that I really do these days. Like, as much as I still read, my stuff is definitely more science fiction than diving into anything else. But that's one of those things that I was very surprising about, just how volatile our, you know, history was. And it's something that we continue to uncover on a you know, daily basis, you know, more and more knowing those things. So that's, again, it's pretty awesome. I'm glad that you're doing it, and I might have to just might have to steal that from you and do the same. But yeah, you know, one of the things that we don't really see a whole lot of, because this is supposed to be post that, but we don't really see a lot of the actual occupation of Bajor.
Yeah,
they do a couple of, you know, flashback things here and there, but for the most part, we don't really see a whole lot of that.
Right.
I know on YouTube there were some people who put together, like, I guess you could call them documentaries about the Bajoran occupation, but again, since it's not something that we ever really see, that's all very much non-canon, fan fiction-y
speculation.
Yeah. Interesting to watch when you're bored on a Sunday and have, you know, ample free time to do a deep dive on Star Trek and on YouTube. But other than that, it's nothing else. But one thing they're really great at portraying on this show is the fact that the occupation, as it rightly would, affected every Bajoran. And, you know, they're all deeply impacted by it. They're all, in a sense, suffering from PTSD from this 50 plus years of an occupying force on their planet.
Right.
So, you know, to see Kira, as you said, she had secured amnesty for Tana and any other Khon Maat to follow him. And to see, you know, she fought for that. That was how she was now using her energies. She was no longer taking up arms against Cardassians, but she was fighting to make Bajor a home.
Right.
And she felt that was just as legitimate a fight as anything that she had done in the Resistance. And to find Tana so anti that obviously really did hurt her. And ultimately, you know, even though she's made her choice, she's made her stand, this is who she's going to be from now on, at the end, when Tana calls her a traitor, yes, definitely, you know, hurt her a bit. You see that kind of, that look on her face. And again, Nana does a great, great job portraying this character. I can't imagine anyone else in that role. I love Kira. She is one of my, you know, my favorite first officers.
Right.
Yes, she's just great. And, Nana Visitor does a great job bringing her to life.
Yeah.
And definitely applaud her for that.
I definitely think she is a great cast for the role. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So we're coming up on it, like, for real. We've got like 2 minutes. real quick, anything that you, I think I already asked you this, anything you're looking forward to in, as the season progresses, anything more you would like to see coming from this episode going forward?
Oh yeah, just everything set up in this episode, from, you know, the wormhole and, you know, how that's gonna play the future. Garrick as this spy, but maybe he's not a spy. Kira and her relationship with Bajor and the Khon Maat, all of that great setup. We have room to really explore what could happen, and look forward to finding out more.
Excellent. And for me, I'm just enjoying, you know, seeing someone else watch this show, and hopefully by the end of you watching it, you will have as much of a love for it. Well, close anyway. I don't think anybody will ever top me and my love for the show, but, hopefully you'll be close there and we can have some, other conversations then. So to that end, guys, be sure to tune in next week. Once again, you can find us on both Twitter and Facebook as The Fire Case, a Star Trek Deep Space Nine podcast. I know we've been a little absent lately, but we'll be back real soon. And again, if you have any questions, any comments you want to make, anything like that, please feel free to send them our way. We'll do our best to answer that stuff once we start to really receive them. But again, as I say, keep it polite. Keep it, you know, HR friendly, basically, because we won't do anything else.
If your mommy wouldn't want you to write that, don't you write that.
There you go. Yeah. I'm not saying it needs to be a glowing, you know, fawning over us because we're impressive individuals and you just love the sound of our voices.
So go ahead.
But yeah, I'm not going to deny that either. But yes, just saying, you know, anything else we're good with, okay? So yes, tune in next week and we will catch you back here in the Fire Caves.
All right. Thanks, guys.
See ya.